Hi, I'm Mark Brody, and this is the Friday Newscap Podcast. Each week, we review the biggest stories with experts, reporters, and commentators to put the news in perspective. Here's this week's episode.
We're looking at 18 months until the next election, and the governor will be on the ballot. So part of the equation will be, is the focus going into getting a governor that'll sign the bill, or does this go on the ballot with it?
This is not business as usual. This is a necessary response to an administration that continues to operate far outside the bounds of the law and the Constitution.
We didn't get everything that we would like to have seen in this bill, but I believe that there were some major accomplishments.
You start asking yourself, what am I doing? And can I do more? And that's, I think, where my heart started to lean towards running for office and actually thinking about it and praying about it.
This is about more than just one man. It's about all of us. What we're witnessing is a constitutional crisis.
There is no going back. We will be kicking off vulnerable women in one of the most difficult times and make them basically take a crapshoot about the birth and health of them, of their babies, and of course, just their own self.
And with me to talk about internal Democratic Party drama, President Trump endorsing a second GOP gubernatorial candidate and more, are Lorna Romero-Ferguson of Elevate Strategies. Good morning, Lorna.
Good morning.
And former congressional staffer Roy Herrera. Roy, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's start with the gubernatorial race. Lorna, President Trump late last year seemed to endorse Karen Taylor Robeson. Pretty much every email she sends out says Trump endorsed Karen Taylor Robeson. And now her primary opponent, Congressman Andy Biggs, has also gotten Trump's endorsement. What does this do to the race?
You know, it's not surprising, right? We saw President Trump do this during the last election cycle for one of the congressional seats between Blake Masters and Abe Hamadeh.
Yeah.
You know, there was a different dynamic there because Abe got the endorsement early on, and then the Blake Masters endorsement was, what, a week or two before the election. So he has a reputation for doing this, right? Saying, I like both candidates in the race. You can't go wrong either way. Obviously, in December, when President Trump was in Arizona, he, you know, in front of an audience, made that endorsement of Karen Taylor Robeson before she'd even announced. And then, you know, Andy Biggs in the new year decides to jump into the race. And so there was a concerted effort from the far right, the Turning Point crowd, to get President Trump to endorse Andy Biggs. So this end result is not surprising. I'm a little surprised that it happened as early as it did. I mean, we're talking about a race that's, you know, next year, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, these folks even announcing their candidacy is early on. We're still recovering from the last election cycle. So one, I'm just surprised he did it so early. But two, I think it's actually beneficial for the Republican primary because it takes that issue off the table. They're both Trump endorsed. Now we can talk about other issues, right? So I think it levels the playing field for both of them. And then you can actually compare the candidates based off of the issues versus the Trump endorsement.
Does it help one candidate more than the other, do you think?
I think it neutralizes it at this point, right?
Okay.
I mean, typically before you would have one Trump-endorsed candidate and a non-Trump-endorsed candidate, and they used it for fundraising, right? And then it used it to try to curry favor with more of the MAGA Republicans in a primary. Now that they're both endorsed, now you really have to make the case to Republican primary voters. Are we going to be talking about the economy? Are we going to be talking about border security, immigration, public safety? So I really think I honestly think for some Republicans, it's a favor that they don't really have to talk about the Trump endorsement as much anymore, and they can actually focus on issues that voters are going to care about in 2026.
Roy, I'm going to go out on a limb here and guess that you don't think this is necessarily a great thing for the Republican primary. Maybe great for Governor Hobbs, but
yeah,
not great for Republicans.
Yeah, I really like this topic. I don't know if I'm going to like some of the topics we're going to talk about a little bit later, but this is a great topic. Because I think it is a great development for Governor Hobbs and her reelection campaign, because I think what it does, to me anyways, is solidify my view that Biggs is going to win that primary. I mean, I kind of already felt that way in some ways, because I think there was always a question about Robeson and whether, you know, the sort of MAGA base would actually, you know, take her for one of their own, right? And whether she was faking it or not. Whereas, you know, there's no question, obviously, that Biggs is a loyal Trump soldier and MAGA member. But now that you have this dual endorsement, which, again, I totally agree with Lauren, is not surprising, kind of given how fickle Trump has been about these kinds of endorsements. To me, it means that Biggs is going to be the nominee. And I think for Hobbs, that is a welcome development because Biggs is, I think, going to be a very weak general election candidate. And I say that primarily because he is you know, pure MAGA. I mean, this is not somebody that's going to try to, I think, appeal to independents or moderates at all in a general election. He's not going to make any kind of pivot or anything like that. He's going to have to take, you know, I think some very difficult votes coming up. And I'm looking at the reconciliation bill, for example, which may have some severe cuts to Medicaid that that he's probably going to vote for. I think that's not going to be politically popular next year. And he's never raised money before. And so all of those things, I think, make him a very weak general election candidate. And this endorsement, I think, to me means he's going to be that general election candidate.
That was a very optimistic take from my Democrat friend when it comes to the Republican primary. I think when I say that the Trump endorsement kind of neutralizes the primary, I think it goes to show that you made a good point. Andy Biggs hasn't had to run for statewide office before. Mm-hmm. He hasn't had to fundraise to the extent that you need to be successful
the
for statewide office.
The fundraising issue seems to be significant
it's
for
significant,
him.
Right? And Karen ran for statewide office before. She, I mean, you saw impressive fundraising numbers that she just released. And so it really is going to come down to who runs the better race in that primary. And I think Karen can pull it off. I definitely think so. I know Democrats, after the endorsement this week, were doing high kicks thinking that it is going to be Andy Biggs winning the primary because they think Hobbs will be successful in that general election matchup. But I think Karen is a dogged campaigner, and obviously she has the resources to be successful, and she's going to run one heck of a campaign.
All right. So, Roy, you kind of alluded to this. Topics that you might not be so enamored of. What is going on with the Arizona Democratic Party?
Well, it wouldn't be Arizona if we're not talking about sort of internal party politics on both sides of the aisle, right? I mean, obviously what happened with the letter from the chairman was an unwelcome development that I think he has caused, you know, himself and all of us. You know, when you've got Senator Kelly, Senator Gallego, Governor Hobbs, you know, all the statewide Democrats, you know, Democrats who have won, you know, the most difficult races, literally have gotten, you know, millions of votes of Democrats and Arizonans over the years. On one side, and then on the other side, you've got, you know, the chairman. Then I think as the chairman, you probably got to look at yourself in the mirror and say, well, maybe I'm wrong here. And so when I saw that letter, on top of the fact that, you know, it was unwelcome that he made it public in the way it was made, I think there's a lot of things in there that were untrue, as far as I know, and mischaracterizations. And the biggest problem here is, you know, the whole point of the party is to get Democrats elected. That's why it exists, so that Democrats can get elected and then enact their policies. And so this letter and the sort of controversy surrounding it gets in the way, and that's really an unfortunate development. Now, the good news is that this has happened early enough in the cycle here where I think there will be an adjustment made, certainly with the governor, you know, running for re-election next year. I mean, she's going to have the organizational infrastructure she needs one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So whether that's through the state party or through another vehicle, it's going to be there. And so right now, you know, I'm just hopeful that there is an adjustment that, you know, perhaps, you know, we can find a way where, you know, Governor Hobbs can kind of have the re-election infrastructure that she wants and deserves as our top of the ticket candidate, and go from there.
So, Roy, we had the chairman, Robert Branscombe, on about a week or so before all this came out. And I asked him about whether the party was unified, because obviously a number of elected Democrats did not endorse him for that role. They endorsed the former incumbent Yolanda Bejarano. And he said the party is unified. We're ready to go. It seems as though that's really not the case.
Well, I think it's largely unified. I'm not sure if he's part of that unity, right? I mean, that's the issue. But I mean, you know, again, you've got all of the statewides, the two senators, the governor, I think working hand in hand with each other, again, on the true focus, what should be the true focus, which is electing Democrats or reelecting Democrats next year. So I think that has happened. And hopefully, again, there are some changes, you know, one way or the other, to make everyone get along going forward next year with that ultimate mission.
So, Lorna, we have talked in the past about some dysfunction within the Republican Party. I wonder if you see parallels, especially between, I think back to, I forget which year it was, but when Kelly Ward was leading mm-hmm. the Republican Party, and a lot of the fundraising went through a county party,
yes.
Republican Party, not the state party. I wonder if you see any parallels between this and some of those other incidents.
There's definitely parallels, and I appreciate Roy's optimism about the Democratic Party's ability to recover from this quickly before an important election next year. I mean, because Republicans the AZGOP, as you mentioned, there have been Republican candidates that were not supportive of the leadership and, yeah, went elsewhere to fundraise and to do all of the typical party efforts that you need to mm-hmm. do in order to support candidates. You also saw third party organizations, you know, emerge. You saw, as Roy mentioned, that, you know, either way, Katie Hobbs is going to have the infrastructure she needs. You saw statewide elected officials that were Republicans that just built up their own grassroots infrastructure, you know, that were registering voters and doing door knocking, stuff that traditionally the party should do. I do think that coming off the heels of 2024 election and that being devastating for Democrats, and then having this kind of this public infighting for the actual party is not helpful, right? I think there's this internal crisis happening of what is the identity of the Democratic Party, right? And yes, you might be unified in getting Democrats elected in this next election cycle, but what kind of Democrats? Are we talking about the AOC, Bernie Sanders crowds that are, you know, doing rallies across the nation, or are you trying to get more moderate folks? And so I think this is going to be a continued issue for the party. It wouldn't surprise me if folks start funneling money elsewhere like they did with the AZGOP. But I don't think this is going to be as quick of a recovery, just because I think there is an identity crisis within the amongst the party. And everybody has a different idea of what the direction should be for Democrats going into 2026. And I'm just not as optimistic as Roy that they're just going to be this kumbaya so quickly before that election cycle.
What is the role of the parties anymore? I mean, especially with super PACs and so many other ways for candidates to fundraise and to, you know, get their messages out and everything. Like, are parties still as important in elections as they once were?
I mean, I would say that they are, and from the standpoint that you do want to see this cohesiveness and you know, this a coalition of Republicans coming together to support other Republicans, right? Mm-hmm. But as we've seen with Republicans and Democrats, there's a lot of internal infighting that usually goes against that mission and that role. There's also, you know, the question of how the leadership decides to use those dollars. Are they using it the most effectively in the best races possible, et cetera? Are they helping down ballot candidates, et cetera? So, and obviously, people disagree with some of that strategy. So, I mean, I think they play an important role. It is not the most important role, because obviously candidates need to run a good campaign. There's outside groups now. There's just a lot that goes into it. So, I mean, having a strong party and a healthy party is helpful. But as we've seen over the past 15, 20 years in Arizona, people figure out a way to still be successful, even if they're not functioning properly.
Lorna, let me start with you on a former NFL kicker, Jay Feely, announcing that he's going to be running for Congress in the seat that Andy Biggs currently holds. But as we just discussed, he's running for governor. How much does name ID and the fact that he played for the Cardinals and was, you know, he's been on TV doing announcing for NFL games for a while, does that help him?
Oh, it definitely helps him, especially in that district where, I mean, I think right now you have three, potentially four candidates jumping in. Who knows? I mean, we still have plenty of time for others to jump in. When you have such a large primary field, name ID goes a long way. Mm-hmm. And then also having the name ID for a fundraising perspective. I mean, running a congressional campaign is not cheap. So, I mean, it does not help him in any regard. And he's also been politically active behind the scenes. I mean, he is pretty close with the Trump administration. He has a good campaign team and infrastructure around him. So this isn't some kind of amateur hour candidacy. So I do think he has a very, very good chance of being successful in that primary. It just goes to – it's a question of who else is going to jump in and potentially pull some voters away from him.
Well, so one of the people we know is in that race is former state lawmaker Travis Grantham. Mm-hmm. And he's clearly – he clearly has a political base in that area because he's been elected before. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, like, when you take that versus professional athlete –
yeah, the name ID is a lot different between a state legislator and a professional athlete.
Yeah.
And then also running a legislative campaign is completely different than a congressional campaign. Mm-hmm. We've seen this throughout our entire career. When a congressional seat opens up, so many people from the legislature resign or decide to run for it. And yes, they've been successful fundraising for a legislative seat, but it's a completely different dynamic and animal when it's congressional. And then also it's different when it's a different field of candidates, right? And so I think Jay Feely will be able to fundraise. It's a question of whether Travis Grantham will be able to. But yeah, I mean, name ID is very helpful in this situation.
Right. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes this week announced that he will be running for re-election. He, of course, kind of flirted with a congressional race in the seat that used to be held by Raul Grijalva. He's been mentioned as a potential gubernatorial candidate. What do you think ultimately did it for him to settle down and run for re-election to his current office?
Well, I mean, I think he was clear in his announcement yesterday. The real reason is he's trying to, you know, protect the security and integrity of our elections from attacks, you know, from, for example, this Trump administration. I mean, he cited the executive order, for example, mm-hmm. that Trump has issued related to elections. I mean, I think it was the right call ultimately. to run for re-election. We needed him, Democrats, and I think the state needed him to run for re-election. And he's going to be going against, I think, most likely Alex Colladin in a general election.
State lawmaker, yeah.
And so, again, I just go back to the kind of similar conversation that we had about Hobbs versus Biggs, where if I'm a Democrat, I'm feeling really good, you know, of with having a Hobbs-Fontes ticket versus Biggs and Colladin, because obviously Colladin is seen as pretty extreme. And he again, is going to do sort of the ultra-MAGA type thing in the general election. So I'm very glad Fontes is running for re-election and we, you know, kind of avoid any other primaries or anything like that that people have been speculating about for a long time.
Well, and when you talk about the 3 years ago, the election, Fontes, especially compared to Chris Mayes and Katie Hobbs, was a landslide that he won by.
That's right. And I think a lot of it, again, thinking about what the Secretary of State does, right, and overseeing our elections, goes back to the fact that I think that there is a widespread support and a feeling in confidence and a desire to protect our elections in Arizona. It's an issue that I think a lot of Republicans, I think, agree with Fontes on. And we saw, you know, Mayor Giles, our former Mayor Giles, mm-hmm. supporting him, you know, other Republicans that are part of his, you know, his team, his leadership team. And they're doing it for a reason, because, again, we have good elections in Arizona and we need to continue making them that way. And I think Fontes is going to do that.
Lorna, we saw something kind of rare this week at the state capitol. We saw a compromise. We saw Democrats and Republicans get together mm-hmm. on a bill to fund the Division of Developmental Disabilities. This, of course, had been a huge political and human issue mm-hmm. for several months now. Was it the deadline that led to this?
I definitely think having a deadline of next week really pushed folks to take action. As you know, as you just mentioned, they knew this was an issue for months now. Mm-hmm. We've been talking about this for months. There were two very animated committee hearings last week about this issue and the best approach to provide funding for the shortfall for those with developmental disabilities and their caregivers. I do think the deadline was helpful. I'm glad they reached a compromise. This was not something that Republicans and Democrats should have been debating in such a political manner for the past few months, especially the past few weeks, mm-hmm. and when you're talking about such a vulnerable population. But I'm glad they reached a compromise. Governor Hobbs signed it. And then now it's just time to really talk about a budget for next cycle, which isn't really being talked about very much.
Yeah, I mean, Roy, does this lend any hope maybe that the two parties can work together productively on a budget, given that they came together on this issue?
No. I mean, at least to the extent that we, you know, if you put emphasis on the word productively, right? I mean, they will have to agree on a budget. They have to, right?
Yeah.
So at some point,
eventually.
But I don't think that the bipartisan deal related to this program is going to lead to sort of any kind of future, you know, moments of bipartisanship. Although I really like bipartisanship, and so I'm very mm-hmm. glad that this happened in the way it did. But I think it's kind of the unique circumstances of the program and obviously how public and how political it got, and the families, the caregivers that were down at the Capitol, I think really forced this issue. And I'm glad it got done. I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of scorekeeping going on by some of these electeds, but at the end of the day, it got done, and that is a good thing for the state. But I don't think it's going to help as we sort of go down the road here with this budget. And, you know, again, I think we're barely starting in that process now. So who knows, if this is going to go into the summer. It seems likely to me.
Way to dash everybody's hopes, Roy. Thanks. Well, so, Lorna, we mentioned the deadline of the money running out next mm-hmm. week. But there's also the added, I wonder about Governor Hobbs' veto threat. Like, did that play a role? We saw it work with Governor Brewer. We saw it work with Governor Ducey. Did it work for Governor Hobbs?
You know, as somebody who worked for a governor that did many bill moratoriums. I mean, I think it's a different dynamic, right? I worked for Governor Brewer when she issued a bill moratorium, you know, during Medicaid and other very intense negotiations that she was having with Republican and Democratic leaders at the legislature. Governor Ducey did it as well. It always depends on the context and the relationships down there, right? And so I don't think it was necessarily the bill moratorium that did it, because, I mean, she had bills on her desk that she signed after she said, it's anything else you send to me, right? So, and we're so far along in the session where I don't think the leverage was necessarily there. I think it was more of the deadline that was impending. And then also the amount of parents and families and individuals that came down to the legislature and have been lobbying their lawmakers about this, I think that was probably the most effective aspect of it, not necessarily the bill moratorium.
What do you think, Roy? Did the governor's veto threat matter here?
It has to matter a little bit, right? I mean, because there definitely were bills I think the Republicans wanted signed during that interim period that the governor was saying no to. So it's a tool in the toolbox. But, you know, I do agree with Lorna that I think the biggest influence had to be, and, you know, you saw it on the news every day, of the parents and the caregivers and the families going down there saying, you know, we need support, we need this funding in order to take care of people. And that's what ultimately won the day. And so I'm glad. I mean, that heartens me a little bit that like that kind of direct efforts from families can still influence these lawmakers to do the right thing.
All right. We'll have to leave it there, guys. That is Roy Herrera, Lorna Romero Ferguson. Thanks you both for coming in. I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Friday Newscap from KJZZ's The Show. It's an original podcast recapping the week's biggest stories with experts, commentators, and reporters. You can get the full show podcast at podcast.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening.